Hello and welcome to the first quarter 2024 results announcement for Arrow Global. My name is Sergey and I'll be your coordinator for today's event. Please note this call is being recorded and for the duration of the call, your lines will be on a listen-only mode. However, you will have the opportunity to ask questions at the end of the call. This can be done by pressing star 1 on your telephone keypad to register your question. If you require assistance at any point, please press star 0 and you will be connected to an operator. On the call, we have Zach Lewy, CEO and CIO, and Phil Shepherd, Group CFO. I will now hand you over to your host, Zach Lewy, to begin today's conference. Please go ahead, sir.
Thank you, Sergey. And my name is Zachary Lewy. I'm the CEO of Arrow Global. We had a very steady quarter in what is clearly a big delivery year, and we've made good progress in a couple of key areas and are confident around the rest of our forward progression in all of our key areas to create the leading vertically integrated fund manager in our space. We have focused hard over the last few months on expanding our lending strategy. This is a direct progression from having acquired Maslow last year. It puts us in a very strong place to take advantage of the good market environment for real estate lending, and we are making good progress and expect a very imminent close of a significant amount of capital driving our lending strategy from the historical SMAs and managed accounts that have been the capital providers to that strategy to moving towards not just having their capacity, but also having the capacity of discretionary funds in our core strategies in the lending area. So we look forward to updating on that in the coming periods. We also made a significant addition both to our client base and to our platforms when we acquired Amitra, the Spanish master servicer from the Canadian Pension Plan Investment Board, CPPIB. That was a long transaction in the making as we built a relationship with CPPIB over time. It was an important strategic transaction for us on both sides of the vertically integrated franchise. On the platform, it got us a scale position in Spain. We had a few small pilots in Spain historically, but nothing of size to be a main market player in Spain. Amitra definitely comes with that scale, with the 4 billion euros of AUM in the Spanish market. And so by the time you combine it with our already strong position in Portugal, we create a very leading business in Iberia with 15 billion euros of assets under management and also strong capabilities between the Iberian elements of the business in all of our key areas, mortgage servicing, NPL servicing, lending, and real estate equity. And so that positions us very strongly on the ground to be a leader in Iberia. It also welcomes CPPIB to our client base from a investment perspective, and we look forward to expanding that partnership over time. Across the existing strategies and our core activities, we originated 187 million euros in Q1. You'll recognize that Q2 is typically the stronger of the first half quarters as banks clean up their balance sheets for the half year. And we do expect to deliver the run rate we targeted across H1 and has already seen a strong start to Q2. The fund manager grew strongly, up 63% year on year, as you start to see the benefit of that strategy with the capital light growth being significant, and with the lending strategy coming into that EBITDA in due course, ACO2 getting more deployed, and the real estate equity strategy also quite active, we would expect that fund management EBITDA segment to continue to perform very strongly period over period. We collected 56.9 million in the quarter, which was ahead of ERC. As you guys will know, we have more than 300 million to go in collections this year. We're still confident in that forecast. We see good progress around the collection side. And so this year is a big ERC collection year, and we're happy with that position. So we'll obviously talk to you more about that in the second half of the presentation. The mechanical result of all of that is that leverage reduced slightly. Again, so we'll talk through that, but there's been no change in our outlook on leverage. It's still deleveraging is our strongest priority. So we're happy with the business model progress. It's a big year, both in terms of improving the franchise, both on the platforms we have, the quality of our clients, the growth of our fund manager, collecting out our back book and deploying the capital in good risk-adjusted returns. And we look forward to talking you through that in more detail through the course of this presentation. Moving to page 4 on credit opportunities, ACO2 continues to perform very strongly. We're still at a 20 IRR. We still are at a 1.9 multiple, which for a credit fund is a high point in the cycle. We really like the shape of that book. There's been an increase in restructurings of both assets, real estate positions, and companies that banks have been willing to sell. I guess with interest rates higher, banks see a higher opportunity cost of just extending and pretending. And so we do see more single names getting sold, and our franchise harvests those well. On ACO1, we've had a strong quarter. We distributed $60 million in the quarter back to our LPs and are continuing to make realizations at roughly that level in a consistent fashion through H1. And so we'll make further distributions, which obviously set the stage for happy investors and a strong fundraise in the future as we move to ACO3 in due course. We're trending to be about 50% deployed in ACO2 by the half year, slightly over that level, which I think is right on track to where we'd want to be. On real estate lending, as I've mentioned a couple of times, that is a core focus of our activity. And again, we'll come back to you as soon as we have announceable materials. Obviously, with the SEC rules, we can't announce live fundraisings in that form, but we're making good progress on plan to what we want to achieve on lending. On real estate equity, our original fund is fully deployed. We're happy with the positions there. It was obviously a good time to be a real estate equity investor through that period. And again, under the SEC rules, we can't comment on existing fund raises, but we're optimistic around closing additional real estate equity positions that will enable us to continue to deploy that strategy, both with the original investors and with a growing investor base in that real estate equity position. You'll remember we hired Zach Vaughn in that space, who was an executive who ran part of Brookfield in Europe, and he has settled in well, and his presence leading our real estate equity business is definitely the newest growth part of Arrow that I think with the footprint we have and with the time in the cycle that creates good opportunities for new capital, you know, new dry powder going into those real estate equity opportunities. You know, we're having a good run of basically preparing that. Obviously, the real estate equity strategy is quite a bit smaller than ACO at this stage. Lending, we do intend to be quite a big strategy, and you get a sense between them. So we would expect ACO to remain the biggest for the time being, given its large existing size and almost 20-year track record. Lending will be quite substantial in size. Real estate equity will be a bit smaller, and then we'll grow those franchises through the cycle as different market environments create better opportunities for the different elements. If I move to page 5, you get a sense of how the vertically integrated fund manager is coming together. So we continue to have very strong platforms, and as you see, we now have 22 of them, which is a strong market position. We've grown those considerably over time. And so when you look at the growth, not just in us acquiring platforms in a thoughtful way, in a progressive manner, but we've also organically built these out in a very strong way once we've owned them. In the last 12 months, we've won more than $15 billion of new contracts on the servicing side. Obviously, we announced a Mitra one at that time. We've talked about a big Irish contract historically on these calls. The Zenith 3 billion euro contract win was in the newspapers. When you add up all of them, it's more than $15 billion of new servicing mandates over the last 12 months. So it continues to evidence just how leading the actual on-the-ground franchises are. And as we talk about with our investors on a consistent basis, we really think the European mid-market is the natural place for opportunities, that in reality Europe is split up between 44 countries, 24 languages, 7,000 local banks, and that highly fragmented local environment means that most asset sales are actually medium in size just naturally due to the fragmentation. And having all of these platforms with such large local footprints puts us in a strong position to harvest what we think are the most interesting opportunities, and how those feed into our fund is ticked on the bottom of page 5. So you see how the different platforms feed, whether it's our credit strategies, our real estate lending strategy, or our real estate equity strategy. And so not only are we able to pool expertise between the different businesses, there is good alignment between the platforms we own, which obviously the market is using in a substantial fashion, helping to grow the capital light EBITDA as well, but also which create great opportunities as origination and underwriting skill sets to underwrite the investments for our funds. Moving to page 6, you see some of that in further detail. We continue to build the client base on the investor side. As you see, it's a very institutional client base. Many of the commitments we have are well over 100 million, and some are now approaching the billion euro level. And so in practice, this is a very institutional, scalable investor base, and we are increasingly becoming their partner of choice for the European middle market. As you saw on the prior page, there's going to be very limited appetite from investors of this size to run around and do 20 separate local strategies in Europe. That's a very fragmented and subscale approach. And so Arrow's capacity to bring, these 22 platforms and these different strategies into one consolidated European middle market proposition to these institutional clients is proving very attractive. In more casual parlance, we are their go-to partner for Europe, and convincing them that the European middle market is the interesting area and that our business model is the attractive one to access it, I think is a battle we're winning every day, and you see the growth from that, and you'll see the growth throughout the rest of this year. In terms of deployment, we're remaining very selective. I think you see the mix of strategies is starting to play in. I think if you see this chart fill in over the rest of H1, you'll see it back to run rate. Obviously, Q1 was slower than we otherwise would have wanted, but I think the balance of H1 will be on track. And so we're pleased with that progression and the diversified nature of the fund manager expanding. From a performance perspective, it continues to go well. We continue to collect well. Even ACO2 collected 48 million euros in the quarter. So even the new funds are throwing off good levels of cash. And so we continue to progress in the ordinary course across our funds, as you see on the bottom of page 6. If you then look at it more from a year-on-year progression on page 7, I think we've progressed nicely across many of the key metrics that matter. You start to see the value of our fund manager and the whole vertically integrated model is growing strongly. That will continue to be the focus point of the business. We are investing. We obviously brought on the real estate team and the lending team. We acquired Maslow. We've built out the fundraising team. As we've done these different things, we've carried those costs until they've built out their discretionary funds. You'll start to see the real benefits of that very shortly as we announce the different closings in those areas. But despite carrying those effectively formation costs around those additional strategies, we've still grown capital A EBITDA very significantly, even despite that cost of growing the business that we've also carried. Obviously, over time, in the growth of the fund manager, the scale is incredibly important, and having wonderful clients like CPPIB and the wider institutional base that you've heard about in prior periods and you've seen on prior slides, combined with our leading on-the-ground footprint and the complementarity of the strategies, all of which are asset-backed, lower mid-market strategies, is really positioning Arrow as a leader in that space and creating the scalability for that to be highly effective over time as we convert those new areas into contributing to the EBITDA in current periods. And so, as you see from the different key metrics, I think we've made progress in each of the areas. Obviously, this is a big delivery year, so we're not confused that this is a moment of triumph at this stage. I think where we're at is clearly making progress. The strategy is clearly working, and the proof is in the eating of the next three quarters of both delivering the collections, thereby deleveraging, delivering the growth of the capital light business, which you'll see just naturally through the pull-through of deploying capital that we've already raised and raising new capital to create the ground of future growth, all of which will come from growing funds under management, and will continue the virtuous cycle that all of that delivers. Now that we're only co-investing at the 10% level, obviously the ROE on all of that activity is very strong, and so management's entire focus is just executing that core strategy, which has the deleveraging effect that is our top priority. And with that, I'll hand to Phil.
Thanks, Zach. Good morning, everyone. I'll start by explaining the group's cash performance for the quarter, which is shown on slide 9. Collections were $57 million, representing a pleasing 102% of ERC. Collections are lower than the comparable period last year for a number of reasons. Firstly, collections last year included those on 100% of the UK portfolios, which were divested during mid-2023. This year, collections only include those on the 50% retained portion. Secondly, an increasing proportion of our ERC and collections are reported net of servicing costs. For example, the 50% retained UK portfolios have collections reported after servicing costs, and approximately 60% of the ERC is now reported net of servicing costs. Thirdly, the collections profile for secured and collateral-based investment portfolios are lumpy in nature and mean that comparisons from one quarter this year to last year are less relevant. The year-on-year collections profile has resulted in decreases to the adjusted EBITDA and free cash flow for the quarter, but free cash flow generation after investments continued to be positive at $3.7 million for the quarter, with leverage reducing by 0.2 times and net debt by $30 million over the last 12 months. The collections profile for 2024 remains strong, with the ERC for the remaining 9 months of the year in excess of $300 million, which is expected to lead to the continued decline in leverage and repayments of net debt. However, most importantly, we continue to scale our integrated fund manager proposition. The growth in capital-light revenues combined with the lower 10% co-investment level will improve the cash generation of the business and enable sustainable deleveraging over the medium term. Moving on to the segmental results and starting with the integrated fund management segments shown on slide 10. The integrated fund management segment represents the capital-light revenues of the group from our integrated asset management and servicing and fund management activities. EBITDA has increased from Q1 last year to Q1 this year by 63% to $13.8 million, with reported revenues up $13.4 million or 30% year on year. And this is driven by the increased revenues as we expand our integrated fund management franchise with increased management fees as fund NAV grows and the ongoing continued strong appetite for our services from clients, with asset management and servicing contract wins, in particular across Ireland, Italy and the Netherlands, with 15 new servicing mandates won during the quarter. As we've reported in previous quarters, the ongoing build of NAV and operational leverage continues to widen the EBITDA margin, increasing from 18.9% for Q1 2023 to 23.7% for the first quarter of 2024. I expect both the EBITDA and EBITDA margin to continue to grow as we scale FUM, growing management fees, asset management, fund administration and servicing fees, and in time recognising carried interest, with revenue growth continuing the trend of outpacing cost growth. The progress in developing our three investment strategies and the ongoing build of our platform footprint, in particular with the expansion into Spain, will ensure that the group can continue to expand origination, which in turn builds FUM and delivers the capital-light earnings growth. Turning to slide 11, where I have set out the IFM profitability by our core discretionary strategies and our local ancillary platform strategies. This split is in line with how I presented the results at the year end and comprises three key components. Firstly, the integrated returns delivered from our core discretionary strategies, with funds under management at the end of Q1 of 4.5 billion. This is the full capital-light fees, including management fees, asset management and servicing fees, and in turn carried interest across our discretionary funds, ACO, our real estate fund, ARIO, and in time, our lending fund. To reiterate, we have previously guided that returns generated from such strategies are circa 40% on capital invested, assuming a 10% co-investment. This is broken down as circa 30% capitalized income, which is reported within the IFM segment, and circa 10% balance sheet return reported in the balance sheet segment. The capital light return of 30% is broadly split 10% management fees, 10% asset management and servicing fees, and 10% carried interest. Based upon NAV of 2.5 billion at the end of the quarter, with an average NAV of 2 billion sterling, the EBITDA is circa 10 million for the quarter, or 40 million on an annualised basis, reflecting the 20% from management fees and asset management and servicing fees, since carried interest is only recognised towards the end of the fund life. The second element relates to the returns from our local ancillary platform strategies, equating to 4.8 billion of our FUM. This includes third-party asset management, fund administration and servicing activities, and the internal income generated by our platforms servicing the ARO back book, which is an intra-segmental charge between IFM and the balance sheet segment. The returns on these activities typically blend to an average EBITDA margin of circa 15%, but like all our capital-light income, are still very stable. Based upon revenue of 35 million for the quarter, the EBITDA is circa 5 million. Thirdly and lastly, there have been costs of circa 1 to 2 million to drive future revenue growth. This creates a drag to the segmental EBITDA and is decreased from the 10 million for the full year 2023. Combining these three elements enables a full understanding of the EBITDA for the IFM segment for the quarter. It also shows the strong progression that the group is making in driving the growth in capital-light earnings in line with our strategy. Slide 12 shows the results for the balance sheet segment. This segment reflects the investment returns of the backbook investments, along with the returns generated on our co-investments in our discretionary funds. EBITDA has increased by 4.8 million to 17.6 million for the quarter. The year-on-year improvement is primarily driven by two factors. Firstly, the results for the prior year were impacted by the divestments of the U.K. portfolios, with no revenue or costs reported within the underlying results in Q1 2023. The results for this year include revenue and costs on the 50% retained by Arrow and amounted to an EBITDA of 3.4 million for the first quarter. Secondly, there was a marginal write-up of the portfolio investments following our usual reevaluation of our ERC at each quarter end. This led to a small write-up of 2.5 million this year, compared with a 1.6 million write-up in the same period last year. Turning now to the collections performance, which is shown on slide 13. Whilst the economic backdrop continues to remain challenging, the group has delivered collections performance exceeding our expectations, with collections of 56.9 million, representing 102% of ERC. The group continues to focus on cash performance, with our local platforms central to ensuring that realizations can continue to be made at above ERC. Collections were lower than last year. However, it's important to understand the reasons behind the decrease, as a direct year-on-year comparison is less relevant than for a business with high levels of unsecured portfolios with smooth collections profiles. As mentioned earlier, there are three reasons for the decrease. Firstly, last year, collections on 100% of the U.K. portfolios were reported. Following the divestment midway through 2023, collections are now included on the retained 50% only, and collections on this portion are included net of servicing costs rather than the gross collections. And this dynamic is increasingly relevant, with around 60% of our ERC reported net of servicing costs. Lastly, the collections profile for secured and collateralized investment portfolios are lumpy in nature. The collections are typically driven by the sale of the underlying real estate, which results in the lumpy profile. And during the remainder of 2024, the group expects to realize significant collections, with ERC for the remaining 9 months amounting to in excess of 300 million, compared with 57 million realized during the first 3 months of the year. Our collections performance across all types of portfolios and all geographies demonstrates the ability of our local platforms to continue to drive and accelerate collections performance. I believe our ERC continues to reflect assumptions in line with the uncertain outlook and broader economic expectations, and we continue to adopt a cautious approach to the underwriting of new portfolio investments. The strong collections profile during 2024 is expected to lead to strong free cash flow generation and strong progress towards our leverage target of 3x. Moving on to the group segment, which is shown on slide 14 and primarily relates to the centrally controlled overhead costs. The segmental costs are broadly consistent with prior year, with a cost of 7.6 million for the quarter. As noted at the full year, the group segmental costs are reflective of a business scaled to deliver 1.5 to 2 billion volumes per annum, without any need for significant group segmental cost increases. The full underlying income statement is shown on slide 15, which shows the EBITDA segmental results that I have already explained. The loss has improved by 6.8 million to 3.6 million, driven by the increased capitalized earnings and improved profitability reported within the balance sheet segment. Finance costs have continued to increase as the impact of rising interest rates continues. Financing costs were 26.6 million, 1.3 million higher than prior year. In addition, as the group grows the euro income, predominantly due to the growth in management fees and in due course carried interest on our funds, the group is maintaining a euro net euro liability position. The retranslation of this liability position gives rise to some non-cash P&L volatility and was a 1.9 million gain this quarter, broadly comparable with the gain of 1.6 million reported last year. Moving to slide 16 and the detailed breakdown of the free cash flow generation. Free cash flow generation was $27.2 million, with free cash flow generation after portfolio investments of $3.7 million. Despite the collections profile during the quarter, free cash flow generation after investments continued to be positive, benefiting from the increasing capital light revenues and the reinvestment in new portfolios, predominantly via 10% co-investment in ACO2 and AREO. As we scale our business across credit, real estate and lending, the increasing levels of capital light revenue will continue to drive free cash flow and enable the deleveraging of the business. In addition, the collections profile for the remainder of 2024, with ERC for the 9 months period in excess of $300 million, is expected to generate strong free cash flow for the year as a whole. Slide 17 shows the net debt position. As noted, the collections profile during the quarter of the first quarter of 2024 has led to positive free cash flow after investments in new portfolios. However, net debt increased by $19 million during the quarter, reflecting the payment of staff bonuses in the quarter. Other than this impact, working capital movements were broadly neutral. The strong collections profile for the remainder of 2024, together with the growth in the capitalized integrated fund management EBITDA, is expected to lead to net debt reduction for the full year as a whole, and is in line with our strategic targets. Slide 18 shows our leverage and funding position. The growing capitalized income and the free cash flow after investments have driven the reduction in leverage of 0.2 times to 4.2 times, and the reduction in secured net debt of $13 million over the previous 12-month period. Leverage has increased from 3.9 times at the year end, predominantly driven by the lower collections profile during the quarter. However, as I've mentioned, the collections profile for the remainder of 2024 is strong, and with the continued growth in capitalized earnings and the collections profile, I expect the group to make good progress towards our medium-term target of 3 times by the year end. And further deleveraging remains a core focus. Leverage has decreased from 4.8 times at the end of 2021, shortly after the take private transaction. We have a strong funding base with no bond maturities until 2026. The weighted average term on our debt is 3 years, and we had $208 million of liquidity headroom. Our 120-month ERC was $1.3 billion, and as noted previously, approximately 60% of this ERC is now reported net of servicing costs, and this percentage continues to rise. The strength of our liquidity and funding position, the considerable time until the group needs to undertake any refinancing, the strong free cash flow generation expected during 2024, together with our capital light model, leaves us well placed to continue to progress the expansion of our integrated fund management model across credit, real estate and lending. This in turn further drives capital light revenue growth without placing strain on our balance sheet and facilitates net debt reduction and further deleveraging towards the strategic leverage commitment of 3 times. Thanks, and I'll now hand back to Zach.
Thanks, Phil. So moving to the wrap up on page 20, I think we would continue to highlight that you're starting to see the pull through of that fee order book into the strong EBITDA for the integrated fund manager in Q1. You'll continue to see that grow positively in a strong way. You'll also see a big year on collections as we move through the remaining quarters of 2024. As we continue to add high quality clients alongside the incremental new strategies that now work well off our existing platform, we continue to feel like we can sweat the assets harder by having effectively three business strategies, three family of funds all in that discretionary high ROE category, pulling origination, underwriting, and servicing, and delivering our investors really attractive access to the asset-backed European middle market that have attracted and continue to attract strong fundraising outcomes, which you'll see over the course of 2024. That puts us just through the natural evolution of collecting more, obviously the reduction in our co-invest from historically using 100% our own capital, then 25% in ACO 1, now only 10% in ACO 2, and lower levels over time towards just an increasing capital light execution, leading to a natural deleveraging, obviously as carry and other income streams add to the denominator, it brings the debt down in the natural way, and you'll see that over the course of this year and next. So we continue to be in good shape ahead of the bond refinancing that we'll do in the coming periods, and we continue to grow the rest of our franchise in a really positive way across all of our stakeholder groups, whether it's our corporate stakeholders, whether it's our clients, whether it's our employees in the platforms, or the wider Arrow community that we touch across all of our platforms, all of our upstream and downstream investor base. We feel like the maturity of the model as the leading vertically integrated fund manager in Europe is clear and continuing to have positive traction. And with that, Sergey, if you don't mind, we'll pass the questions. Thank you.
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, as a reminder to ask a question at this time, please signal by pressing star 1 on your telephone keypad. If you find that your question has already been answered, you may remove yourself from the queue by pressing star 2. And please make sure the mute function on your phone is switched off to allow your signal to reach our equipment. Again, it is star 1 to ask a question. And our first question comes from Max Watton from Partners Group. Please go ahead.
Hi, Zach and Philip. Can you hear me okay?
Yes, thanks.
I just wanted to probe a bit on the collections that you're expecting over the course of the remainder of the year and how that compares to last year. So you obviously had the interim sale that came through in Q2 23. And if I look at your collections over Q2 to Q4 23, it was just shy of 300 million, you know, which isn't too far away from the 300 million that you say you're expecting for the remainder of this year. So with that in mind, I'm just trying to understand how you expect there to be such a significant amount of deleveraging over the course of this year, driven by that, you know, collections trend.
So, I'll take the start of that, Phil, then maybe you go from there. As Phil's pointed out around the lumpiness of how collections work, I understand, Phil, why you asked the question. I understand when you look at it cold, the comparability draws out, I think, a really intuitive assessment as you've done. If you're in the weeds of what's in the actual ERC and when investments roll off, whether they're fund investments or back book investments, there are some lumpier things in those two asset bases that make, and I guess that was the point Phil was making of period over period comparisons that make that it kind of it not directly comparable. And so let me answer the question this way by saying, I mean, Phil and I obviously have, as does the team, literally asset by asset disposal line of sight. And we obviously aren't fools. We wouldn't be sitting here telling you that that's what's going to happen if we didn't have a clear visibility of the sale pipeline asset by asset in a way that makes that ERC deliverable in the form in which we're describing. But to answer your question analytically, you'd have to literally go asset by asset and take a view as to what's going to get sold / realized / collected when. But when you do that bottom-up analysis, if you literally sat with the data tape of our whole book, you would have confidence that the two would match up in the way we're describing.
But I guess my question isn't that taking into consideration, you know, that you expect, you know, collections of 300 million this year, and I'm not questioning that. I'm simply stating that for leverage to decrease, EBITDA on an LTM basis needs to increase. And if the collections profile for the remainder of this year is broadly the same as it was over Q2 to Q4 last year, how does that collections profile drive LTM EBITDA growth?
Clearly you've got the growth in the capitalized earnings coming through, which is additive. So you're right. The collections profile is the same. Clearly, an increasing proportion of that collections profile is now net of servicing costs rather than last year gross of servicing costs, and therefore there's some improvement in that regard. And then it's the growth in the capitalized earnings as well, which is driving the denominator. And then on the numerator side, clearly we made investments during the course of last year, predominantly with the Maslow acquisition, and therefore you would expect net debt reduction coming through this year as you've got that growth in capitalized earnings as well as a lower level of, or an expected lower level of investments in the scaling of the business. We did the heavy lifting really in terms of creating the three verticals across credit, real estate and real estate lending last year, and therefore I wouldn't expect that same level of investment required this year. Does that answer your question, Matt?
Yeah, I mean, I guess to summarise, you're effectively saying that the sort of the cash EBITDA that's generated from the balance sheet business, you know, will improve slightly, even though the level of collections, you know, over the next 9 months will be broadly similar because the margins are going to be a little bit higher because it's net of servicing costs. And then you're saying, you know, the main driver of growth is really going to come from the growth in the asset light LTM EBITDA plus a bit of cash flow generation to reduce net debt.
Correct. Yep.
Okay. And I guess my next question is then, when I look at the ERC profile for 2025, I think it's done on a cumulative basis on slide 24. So, you know, you're broadly expecting sort of 240 million sterling of collections in 2025, which would be, you know, a sort of material reduction for, you know, what you're expecting for this year. So I guess the question is, do you feel like the growth in asset light EBITDA will be sufficient over 25 to offset, you know, the reduction in collections that you're going to see and therefore cash EBITDA from the balance sheet business?
I think we might see a slight uptick in leverage in 2025 from the end of 2024. But clearly the quality of earnings from the fund management business and the stability of those are obviously far higher value than a cash collection from a balance sheet business. I mean, this is fundamental to the understanding of the value of the business on a go forward basis. That's that shift to capital light. And certainly, you know, once you go past 25 into 26, and we clearly showed the examples about how the growth in the EBITDA margin and the EBITDA can be delivered in the examples that we put in the appendix this time and we ran through at the full year. Once you get to a situation where those capitalized earnings are generating that free cash flow and you're only reinvesting at a 10% level, then you get to the position where the business just continues to generate that free cash flow without the sort of the impacts of the lumpier back book cash flows coming into consideration. And at that stage, the business just continues to de-lever.
Yeah, okay. I guess it just feels like there's maybe a little bit of a contrast between, you know, that 3x leverage target and progress being made towards it versus, you know, EBITDA most likely, you know, declining over the course of 25. Seems like you would require a pretty significant amount of cash generation to offset that, but that's more of a comment, I guess. And then my final question is just on the acquisition that was made in the quarter from CPP IB. Could you provide some colour on the cash outflow related to that spend?
Yes, it was in the announcement. It's set out. So it was 0.3 million, which is essentially just working capital for the platform. The balance sheet did acquire a small amount of the assets. It was 4 million euros of a portfolio investment combined with that 0.3 for the platform.
Okay, lovely.
So
thanks
for more. Thanks, Max.
Thank you. Our next question comes from Bruno Reed-Cutting from PGIM. Please go ahead.
Yeah, hi, guys. Thanks for the presentation. Just wanted to get more color on just, I guess, the scaling of those asset-light earnings and just how you expect or how we should think about that growth, I guess, throughout the rest of the year. Do you expect to see sequential growth from here, or is this kind of, I guess, you kind of expecting to run this NAV? Just try and get a steer, I guess, on how much servicing income is to come in from both the ACO funds, but, you know, I guess we're kind of running it now, so I guess the asset management fees are probably on a run rate basis, but how should we think about the scaling on that capital light EBITDA through the rest of the year?
Yeah, I guess, Bruno, as we ran through at the full year, clearly origination drives the fee-paying NAV for the discretionary core strategies, and that in turn drives the capitalized earnings for those strategies at the 20% level, because we won't be recognising carried interest during the course of this year. So in terms of the, you know, we clearly gave a couple of charts at the full year announcement, which enabled you to model through the, you know, that link between origination volumes and fee-paying NAV, and therefore the earnings. The second element is the answer, the local ancillary platform strategies, which we'd expect to grow at mid-high single digits on an EBITDA basis during the course of this year. And then you've seen that drag of the investment that we're making has reduced from the 10 million for the full year last year to 1 to 2 million for the first quarter this year. And clearly as those in particular the lending strategy comes on board, then you should expect to see that drag continue to reduce.
Okay, but I guess the sort of the 14 million number you printed this quarter, I guess you're saying that should grow sequentially from here, just to understand that point.
The 40 million on an annualized basis just for the core strategies will grow as fee pay NAV grows, and that's linked to the origination clearly. Zach gave the sort of expectations for that during the second quarter, but you're right, it should grow in line with that.
Yeah. Okay, that's helpful. So I kind of have you guys, obviously, if you can, you know, come good on that, those strong collections you have this year. I mean, what is the use of proceeds of that cash? Is it to clean up the RCF to put you in a better position to refinance the bonds back end of this year, beginning of next year? Is that the plan of the free cash flow?
Yeah, I mean, we continue to sort of there's a balance, isn't there, between scaling the integrated fund management proposition. Clearly, it's you know, scaling a fund manager is hugely accretive because you have a relatively high fixed cost base, and therefore, you know, getting that balance between reinvesting into the business and repaying debt is something which, you know, we've been acutely aware of. I think, as I just mentioned, I think the heavy lifting in terms of creating the three investment strategies, clearly, you know, through the drag of the investment that we made last year together with, you know, predominantly the Maslow acquisition, meant that we probably invested into the IFM franchise more heavily than I think we need to do on a go forward basis. So yeah, I would expect the majority to be going to debt repayments.
Okay, that's helpful, Carlos. Thank you. That was kind of in line. And then I guess just lastly, just on this working capital outflow you had in the quarter, I think you previously guided to be flat for the full year. Could you just maybe comment? I know you had some bonus payments that went out, so just maybe comment on the size of how much that working capital's bonus. And I guess just like, are you still standing by your comments that should be neutral for the full year, so we should see that kind of cash come in?
Yeah, I mean, essentially it was working capital aside from the bonus was flat during this quarter, and so as we accrue up, the bonus during the course of this year, I'd expect that to reverse during the future quarters. So yeah, still guiding to flat for the full year.
Okay, all right, helpful. Actually, I have one last question. I don't know if you can comment or not. I don't know what the rules are around the fundraising, but just in terms of the lending strategy that you're running, should we think about that in a similar fashion in terms of it will also have a co-investment feature attached to it and the fee profile? I mean, I guess the performance fee profile will be lower, but I guess similar sort of, I guess similar return profile to the credit opportunities platform that you have?
I can take that. Yeah, yes. I mean, that's the shape of our franchise. I think instead of commenting on the literal specifics of a fund in the market, I'll comment on our broader approach to how we look at funds across lending, real estate, and credit. You should expect that the form of the fund is exactly the same, that the balance sheet will make a co-investment alongside the funds. We have experienced success in getting the level of that co-investment to decline over time. Obviously, we've trumpeted the 25% co-invest in ACO1 falling to 10% in ACO2, and we intend to see a continuing decline in the size of the co-invest. I mean, those co-invests are large by market standards, and as we become ever more established as a fund manager, the requirement for us to co-invest at those high levels has declined. So you will see the size of the co-invest decline. But there will be a co-invest from the balance sheet into each of the funds that we do. And then you'll have the same elements. You'll have a management fee. You'll have a carrier performance fee. And you'll have the servicing fees in the same exact fashion. So the shape of the funds will look the same. Obviously, the exact configuration of those things for lending and for real estate and for credit opportunities won't always be exactly the same. And as those things become completed funds as opposed to things that are live in the market, we will, the same way that Phil expanded the disclosure last quarter, we'll obviously keep updating that in a fashion so you guys can track and model how those roll through our financials.
Great. That's really helpful. Thanks, guys.
Thank you. As a reminder, to ask a question, please signal by pressing star one. Again, it is star one to ask a question. We will pause for just a moment to allow you to signal. And we will now take our next question from Marina Lolland from Chinovari. Please go ahead.
Hi, guys. Thank you so much for taking my question. I was wondering, could you split out like the three in fund management, the three sort of strategies? I think maybe you did. Was it real estate and real estate lending? Or is that, maybe I'm confusing it. But would it be possible to get a sort of net IRR expectation for the next, like, maybe 3 years, 2 years, split across your top three segments in your fund management business, where you're expecting to sort of drive the, that is expected to drive the EBITDA, so essentially just trying to understand a little bit more about sort of that business.
Yeah. Well, again, let me speak slightly generically, but I think I can, be responsive to that. So, I mean, I think we've historically pointed to credit opportunity. Maybe take a step back. So the way we split the world is that the underlying collaterals that we're seeking to service are similar. So asset-backed, often real estate in the European mid-market in the countries where we're strong and we have our platforms. So that's kind of the common foundation across all of our strategies. And then we access our expertise and our scale against that type of collateral through three different parts of the capital structure. We either lend against that collateral, and that goes into our real estate lending fund. That's the thing, obviously, today we've flagged. We expect to show funds under management growth in that lending strategy, and buying Maslow was a core component of having a multi-billion euro attributable track record. I mean, Maslow's done 18,000 units, lent almost 4 billion euros now with a fantastic track record. So that's the lending fund as we talk about it.
Okay.
Then you have credit opportunities. That is things that are bought at discounts to par, right? So that's NPLs, restructurings, bankruptcies, secondaries, things that are bought at a discount. But again, NPLs is the biggest portion of that element. And so that's our current opportunities, and that we've already flagged as an 18 gross historical track record. And I probably won't comment on a public call about gross to net bridge, but you can get the sense of that dynamic. Mm-hmm. And then real estate equity is a couple of different strategies in real estate equity. So we have effectively deep value opportunistic, so similar in style to our other areas where, for example, bank has an REO and sells that. There's a piece of real estate inside a bankruptcy that we can acquire. We're the servicer to a borrower who's overlevered and can't refinance, and so they've got to sell a hard asset. That would go into real estate equity. And so that has a return requirement of greater than 20% because you're buying the hard asset in equity form, which I think at this point in the cycle demands that, in deep value strategy, demands that kind of, premium.
And so that's is that net of financing? Sorry, just is it gross or net when you, 20%?
So that would be the equity IRR as opposed to the asset
sorry.
IRR.
So
that's the shape of what we go to market with and how we invest. I will come back to you in due course. We'll publish as a franchise when we're not in a live fundraising. We'll comment over time exactly the splits, but you should obviously think of, as a lender, the IRRs are lower. Buying it in distress form as a credit opportunity, the IRRs are at that 18 level, and if you buy real estate equity, obviously, you demand a higher premium for that part of the capital structure. So that's broadly the shape of the franchise. And then a lot of the investors are the same across all three areas. But within the investor, you know, the lending tends to go into either real estate credit or direct lending portfolios. Credit opportunities tends to go to either special sits, opportunistic credit, in some cases private credit portfolios, and real estate equity goes to real assets or real estate parts of the portfolio. And so when Phil talks about doing all the work we've done to set up the strategy, that's on both sides of the balance sheet. So we spent a lot of time, obviously, as you saw on the earlier slides that I presented back on slide five, you saw how the different platforms we have feed those different areas, and we're clear which platforms feed which strategies. And then we've also done the work. We hired, you know, Charlotte Gilbert, who is ex-Apollo and Oaktree, who leads our fundraising team, and then we've made a significant range of fundraising hires, as over the last couple of years, we've brought that whole fundraising piece in-house instead of using placement agents, and we've used that fundraising team very actively to deepen our relationships across those different pools of capital inside our LPs. And so as you see both the existing funds raise well, and then you'll see, as we've foreshadowed today, further fundraising activity across those strategies, that is the coming to fruition of all of that work, obviously, which then allows us to sweat the assets hard and the platforms hard, because we're using the same platforms to feed three complementary strategies that all have a similar type of asset at their core, but have different parts of the capital structure where we get to participate.
Right, right. Thanks for explaining. I'm sorry if I'm not that plugged into real estate, but, you know, from just seeing the new build activities, et cetera, I mean, is this a business plan that has changed in terms of what you expect on returns, just in light of, like, where we are in terms of rates and just generally the appetite for, I mean, at least for resi, maybe you can...
Look, it's clearly a very good time to have dry powder in that space, in the sense that, you know, obviously there's a lot of people who were very long real estate in a low rate environment and now are choosing to rebalance towards credit. And that's obviously supporting the growth of our lending pipeline, and that's been helpful. And then on the real estate side, I guess what I'd say is the way we think about the business is, I mean, obviously high rates favors being the lender, low rates favors owning the equity. We would think across the cycle we have a pretty balanced franchise, i.e. that the Credit Opportunities Fund has generally done well in many environments, but obviously does particularly well during a dislocation. The real estate equity does well when rates are lower. The lending fund does well when rates are higher, because you're obviously benefiting from floating rate lending, which is the style of that activity. And so it's an attractive franchise to investors. On your question about real estate equity right now, yes, it is. There are certain investors who are high conviction, who like the deep value space right now because of a lot of different real estate asset types being very dislocated. But as we've signaled, that'll be the smallest of the three strategies. The Credit Opportunities is obviously a multi-billion euro franchise already. We'd expect lending to also be large size. And as we are able to, we'll be more specific about that. And real estate equity is the smallest of those three.
Okay. That's clear. Thank you so much for answering my questions.
Yeah, I'll just jump in. Obviously, all of those returns that Zach's spoken about are the returns for the balance sheet investor, stating sort of the obvious and as we've guided to, clearly where we're just the 10% co-investor, and we're earning management fees on the on that discretionary capital. We're earning performance fees, and we're earning the servicing fees. Then, for generally speaking, we're as we've sort of guided towards, we're earning a 40% return on on capital for our capital that's invested in those strategies.
Yeah, and that's like including hurdle rates, you assume. I don't know if you got what hurdle rates you have, but in terms of the performance fee.
Yeah, it for an on target performance fee. Yeah.
Okay. All righty. Thanks a lot, Phil. It's very helpful.
Thanks.
Thank you. Our next question comes from Neil Simpson, ICG. Please go ahead. Your line is open.
Hello. Thanks for taking my question. A couple ones for me. So just in terms of the leverage cadence, obviously you've talked about making progress towards 3x by the end of the year. It seems like lenders should still expect a step up in leverage as we lap the prior year Q2. Is that correct? And do you have any guidance as to what peak leverage we should expect?
We don't. I mean, clearly, we've got a number of larger portfolios which are collecting out during the course of this year. Whether they fall into H1 or into H2 is, you know, clearly it will impact whether we get a peak leverage, given the divestment proceeds will drop out, as you rightly note, at the end of H1. We're working hard to get as many of those collections coming through in H1. I'd expect that a reasonable lift of the 300 million that we've got to do will be done by the end of Q3. Whether it's done by the end of Q2 is still too early to say. We're working hard on that.
Okay, that's clear. And then in terms of your cost base, so I appreciate you've invested in the new strategies quite a bit. Do you have a number in terms of the like-for-like growth in your overhead costs, just for our modeling purposes? How much of that cost growth is related to the new funds versus, you know, general inflation?
So the fundraising activity goes into the group segment, and therefore, as we've said, that's been flat year on year. So the large portion of the development of that team was done during the course of last year. So I'm not expecting any significant uptick in costs for fundraising activity during the course of this year.
Okay, got it. So if I look at that overhead number and it is flat year over year, does that imply that the rest of the business has seen lower costs or cost cuts? How should I interpret that number, given that you've added on additional investment teams and marketing teams?
And the majority of that was done during the course of last year and relatively early on in last year. So I wouldn't expect, and clearly, you in the figures last year, there was some buyouts and restructuring costs that come with the build of the team. So effectively, it's that element which is basically won't be repeated this year, but you've got a full year of costs coming through this year. Yep.
Okay, got it. That's clear. And then in terms of fundraising expectations, so not sure what you can say, but are you able to comment on the target size for the real estate lending fund and AREO? And maybe if it's expectations.
I think under the SEC rules, we're not allowed to do that. We want to tell you, which is not allowed to. We will clearly, as soon as we're allowed to, we will tell you. But we will keep you updated. I mean, I've tried to guide as best I can within those restrictions to say that Credit Opportunities is a very large strategy, obviously $2.75 billion with the last fund. We'd expect considerable growth fund on fund. Obviously, now that Spain is turned on as a major geography, that is also a helpful growth to the size of the Credit Opportunities franchise. On lending, we'd expect that to be a large activity. I mean, if you look at, I think we can say across all of our platforms last year, we lent something like 1.35 billion euros. A lot of that went into SMEs. None of that was balance sheeted, i.e. those were all third-party constructs. But, I mean, it gives you a sense of the scale of that franchise. It's a meaningful franchise. Not all of that volume would be appropriate for the target of a lending fund, just because some of that is lower-yielding stuff that suited that particular investor. But generally speaking, it gives you a sense, orders of magnitude. We're talking a yep. large strategy, not a small one. And then on real estate, I've said like that will be the smallest. I think that's a function of the fact that, as per prior Q&A today, I mean, real estate equity is a relatively challenging asset. You know, if the senior debt is high yielding and the lending is high yielding, credit opportunities are high yielding, you know, people demand quite a high risk premium to sit in the equity part of the cap stack in real estate at this point in the cycle. And so we're being very selective both on the investment side and the ability to fundraise into that part of the capital structure right now, as people are generally rebalancing away from real estate is more challenging. And so we'd expect the real estate equity pot of capital to be the smallest of the three. We'll be as specific as we're allowed to be as soon as we're allowed to be.
Understood. And I appreciate that. Last question. I think I dialed in late, so apologies. I think you went over this. So can you discuss the nature of the partnership with CPPIB?
Yeah, we covered that up front. I mean, basically, obviously, I want to be sensitive to talking about the specifics of a particular client. What I would say in terms of the relevance is that if you're a large institutional investor and you want to access the asset-backed side of the European middle market, that's relatively difficult. I mean, you can imagine those are very locally fragmented strategies. You know, if you look at Portuguese mortgages or you look at UK construction loans, or we can go through different areas, but each of those little mid-market asset-backed opportunities is by its very nature quite fragmented and localized. You spread that over 44 countries in Europe, and if you wanted to run around, if you were one of these large institutionals, and pick up that asset-backed middle market exposure, which is quite high-yielding and quite complementary to a lot of the corporate credit that a lot of these guys have, and be more asset-backed, accessing that is physically and structurally challenging. And so Arrow plays a very important role for clients like CPPIB by being a single platform where they can access three different parts of the capital structure. They can access, you know, six different countries across 22 platforms, you know, where we service 80 billion and hence are properly scaled. It creates a large footprint for them to operate. And so that deal was strategically beneficial in two directions. One, we had a gap in Spain. They had a massive, you know, 4 billion euros of assets in Spain and a strong platform. We were able to pick that up. Phil gave you the number. We thought that was a very accretive pickup of a Spanish platform that was complementary to our existing holdings and will unlock quite a lot of synergies with our very large Portuguese platform and create a big Iberian, I think, leader in that space. And then obviously CPOB joining our franchise gives them access to all those different areas that we described, and obviously there's arrangements in place around that. So that's probably as much detail as I can give, but that hopefully that gives you a sense of what got achieved there.
Okay, got it. So the future collaboration that you alluded to is their involvement in Arrow and potential future pipeline or assets that they can work to deploy capital.
Yeah, platform. Yeah. I mean, there's specific funds and details that we can't go into that low of detail, but correct, effectively what you said.
Okay. All right. Thanks. That's it for me.
Thank you. Marco Gironi, T. Rowe Price, please go ahead.
Hi. I actually have four questions, but a couple should be quick and just around numbers. So the first one, I'm not quite clear about how you're guiding the trend for your co-investment in 2024. Are you suggesting that would be sort of flattish to last year at around 150, or it trends down to the low 100s? In terms of the co-invest.
Yeah, I mean, so now pretty much the balance sheet investments are the co-invest at 10%. So it's really a function of basically the origination volumes. So the origination volumes will clearly be impacted by the timing of closing ALO, but yeah, sort of the 150 area should be, you know, if origination is in that 1.5 to 2 billion range, then you know, take 10% of that.
Got it. Thank you. And then Phil, to your new divisional disclosure, there's one bit unclear. When I do my cash build up. So I take the IFM fees, the net collections from the balance sheet, take off the central cost, and that gives me basically a cash EBITDA. But when you describe the IFM business and you talked about the local and ancillary platforms, you mentioned that includes servicing the Arrow backbook, which would be an intra-group transaction, an interview arrangement. So I just want to be clear, the 5 million of EBITDA in that ancillary part, does that include something we need to net off, some profit which is actually intra-group?
So yes, so that will include the servicing fees and management fees that the IFM segment charges the balance sheet business. So the balance sheet business that we're reporting, the costs within the balance sheet segment that you see will include those costs and the corresponding.
Okay, so I'm taking off.
The
okay,
RPM.
So yeah.
So
they're coming out of there. Got it.
Yeah, they are. So if you're using the segmental reporting tables and you're taking the costs from the balance sheet segment, you'll be capturing that.
Great. My third question is, you know, we've read press reports of potential interest in, shall we say, going to France. Would you consider adding another geography and a new geography like France in your expansion? Because I'm trying to balance that with the, you know, again, focus on deleveraging and using cash flow to repay debt.
Yeah, I'll take that. I'd say a couple of things to be focused on. So I mean, you've seen the scale in Spain we've just achieved, having spent, you know, 4 million euros, of which the majority of that, as Phil described, went into a portfolio co-invest, I think is an attractive example of us obviously strengthening the platform without spending capital from the parent company and thereby achieving a strengthening of our investor-facing franchise while still prioritizing deleveraging. I think that would be our preferred model across any future geographic expansion, whether that's France or anywhere else. I think I would just be cognizant of you. I mean, obviously, we have a 2.75 billion euro credit fund, which looks at credit opportunities. And so, I mean, obviously I don't want to comment on any specific situations, but I think what the point I would make is more abstract, which is the strength of the Arrow business model is we have over 100 investors. We have some very large LPs. They're looking for credit opportunities. We obviously come with a lot of expertise in the sector. Both operationally and as an investor. And so you shouldn't at all assume that if you read something that's the balance sheet making that investment, in the majority of cases, anything you see in the marketplace are the size of our funds. I mean, it's our co-investment.
And I saw that, and I saw how you structured the Anacap deal. But again, keeping it theoretical here, in a bigger deal where there's both funds and a servicer, can the ACO fund actually run the servicer and own a servicer? Because I would have thought the people would go to the Arrow OpCo and the assets would go to the ACO fund. Structurally, am I thinking that correctly?
It's a very pointed theoretical question.
But in Anacap, you did not acquire a servicer, right?
Well, Anacap did have a small servicer inside. It had a small servicer in Spain called Galatra. Technically, the Credit Opportunities franchise has a lot of structural flexibility. Like most special six mandates, there is a lot of structural flexibility. Without trying to tie ourselves in knots on quite applicable theory, I would say that we're trying to build a long-term GP-owned servicing franchise that feeds our funds as per page 5. Clearly, buying Amitra was very accretive in that regard and had a capital outlay that was very manageable, as we've talked about. I think we have lots of structural flexibility in how the business operates. The fact that we do have a big, wholly owned platform and have large funds and have significant LPs gives us lots of structuring options. And TDR is obviously also a very clever and well-capitalized sponsor. And so across those different elements, we've got a lot of capabilities that I think are relevant to lots of situations, some of which, manifest at this point in the cycle. But that's probably as far as I can go without getting drawn into something that's too much detail given events around the sector at the moment.
Fine. Zach, I appreciate your comments. I know it's not easy. My last question is a numbers one. So 300 million of collections in the next 9 months. If I straight line that, which I know is not appropriate, it's 100 million a quarter. Now, I think from your previous comment, Phil, you mentioned that 2Q and Q3 should be the large ones, right? So it's fair to expect that Q2 and Q3 would be above 100 million, right?
Combined, it will be. Obviously Q4 is traditionally a bigger collections quarter. In terms of the there is a number of portfolios which are reasonably sizable, which are creating the higher than normal collections across the year as a whole, and those portfolios are typically collecting out within Q2 and Q3. So straight line is probably not a bad representation, and some may slip from Q3 may be higher than that average. Q2 may be slightly lower. Q4 is probably on a normal run rate basis is probably not too far off. So yeah, I mean clearly,
thank you for
that. With the timing of these, it does move around given. It's real estate and, often with some capital expenditure and therefore the platforms maximizing that realization is key. And sometimes, that maximization can involve either bringing things forward or delaying things slightly to incur some additional capex, for example. But yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you. Our next question comes from Sam O'Shea, Guggenheim Partners. Please go ahead.
Hi there. Thanks for taking my questions. Two hopefully quick ones for me. Can you firstly just give the percentage of ACO2 that was deployed at the end of the first quarter?
I think the number was orders of magnitude 40%.
Okay, thanks. And then just on the lending fund, so I think the comment was that's expected to close imminently. When should we think about, you know, that starting to show up in the deployments number? Like, could that start to be seen from the second half of the year, or are there anything that would delay that into 25?
Do you want me to take that, Phil, or do you want to take that?
You go ahead. Yeah.
I mean, that would be our aspiration, yes. I mean, let's cross that bridge as we are allowed to announce things, but that's a reasonable assumption for you to hold.
Understood. That's all I have. Thanks.
Thank you. We'll now take our next question from Felix Chung from Sculptor Capital Management. Please go ahead.
Hi, guys. I have one question. More on the refinancing thoughts. Like, when I look at the collection ERC curve, obviously 25, there's a drop-off, and you have, I think, there's still some runway for your IFM business to sort of generate meaningful EBITDA. Just want to gauge, like, you know, how should I really think about, you know, the refinancing of the debt which you have for 26 maturity?
Yeah, I mean, we've said that we'll deal with the refinancing early. We expect to. I mean, I think we are just over halfway through the bonds, as I keep reminding people. So, you know, we're about two and a half years through a 5-year bond. So we've still got plenty of runway and still plenty of flexibility.
Thank you. And we'll take a follow-up question from Marina Lolland from January. Please go ahead.
Hi. So I think actually the OC2, sorry if I'm, that's 40% deployment. Do you need just on your deployment trajectory, is there a risk of cost expansion there? Just, do you have all of the necessary people and all of the sort of, is everything sort of in place to really ramp up to those sort of that runway that we're talking about to get those 40% on that AUM, or is there like new people that needs to come in and systems and in place? So yeah, so that's one question. And the other question.
Sorry.
I'm sorry. And the second question was just if you expect full collection by, I don't know, like Q3, wouldn't it be natural to bring a collections maybe for the following, for 2025 forward, just in light of like where the market is and people are a bit sort of nervous with, I mean, not that you guys are comparable to these unsecured guys, but there's a lot of tension, as you probably are aware, with JFK and Intrum and whatnot. I mean, do you not think it would be sort of good to bring forward collections, grow that EBITDA a bit sort of above sort of on the collection side, as opposed to being so flat year on year, if you do expect to sort of fully realize your collections by Q4?
Let me take those two. I think the on your first question, no, I think we're in good shape to deploy the rest of ACO2 without the need of further cost changes. I think you've seen the costs are pretty flat at the overhead level from here, and most of the rest of the activity is profitable because of either drive servicing fee or equivalent. But I generally speaking, I think the franchise has the foundational shape it needs. I don't think there are significant cost changes we'd expect. On your second question, I guess we're But there's obviously a significant collections profile through the rest of 24. We need to deliver that. There's a need to grow capital light EBITDA so that we, you, all stakeholders see the continuing growing value, which I do think will be progressive as those earning streams are very predictable, flowing down from fees that are all captive. It's a progressive growth in lines with funds under management and then NAV. So that is just the natural roll forward of the existing business model. I think we're trying to obviously address both key points. I mean, one is the one that has durable relevance is that the more quality investors we have, the bigger our funds get off a broadly flattish cost base where you're sweating the platforms to maximize AUM, driving strong capital light growth whilst collecting down the back book and using that cash to pay down debt as opposed to other things. That's clearly the formula we're flagging, and that's what the go-forward is. That by the time carry and other things come into the denominator, that will drive a very attractive business.
Mm-hmm.
I think in terms of the short-term stress, obviously, as you said, from our perspective, we have transformed our business model away from the comps you mentioned very dramatically. I mean, the fact that we have the funds we have so that, using the AnnaCap example, which is in the public domain, we had the capital availability to drive that deal, I think evidences, in the most stark possible terms, the difference between the business models. Having said that, I do obviously get that, there's what you described in terms of sentiment. And so, we're obviously focusing on executing well, and we obviously are cognizant of our upcoming maturities and that we need to show progress in a way that delevers and creates a robust position from which to refinance from a position of strength as opposed to not. And so we're
mm-hmm. Yeah.
We clearly will do what we need to do to
yeah. Fair. That's a fair answer. Thanks. That's really all for me. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. And it appears there are currently no further questions in the phone queue right now. So with this, I'd like to hand the call back over to Zach Lewy for any additional or closing remarks. Over to you, sir.
Thank you, Sergey. Well, appreciate your time and the engagement, and we look forward to catching up with you in August to go through the half-year results. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you. This concludes today's conference call. Thank you for your participation, ladies and gentlemen. You may now disconnect.